This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, this is David Rutledge. You're in the Philosopher's Zone once again. Welcome to the show. If you go to a dictionary or perhaps a dictionary website in search of the meaning of a word, what exactly happens? Like, say English is your second language and you're reading an Australian novel and you come across the word bandicoot. So you have no clue what a bandicoot is. You've never encountered this word before, so you check the dictionary. And what you find when you check the dictionary is not a bandicoot pressed between the pages of the book. What you find is more words. And those words might include terms like marsupial or omnivore or nocturnal. And those words might be unfamiliar and they'll send you off to another part of the dictionary where you will find still more words. The philosophical concept here is that we don't really have any direct, unmediated access to reality, to a world in some sense beyond language. Language keeps getting in the way, to the point where we can perhaps even say that our world, insofar as we know it at all, is constructed by language. So you might not agree with that notion, but what I've just given you there is a crude thumbnail sketch of an idea that has really dominated philosophy for roughly the past century. And the process by which this idea took root has come to be known as the linguistic turn. It's a turn that philosophy took around the beginning of the 20th century when language and the technical theorizing of language began to be the name of the game. As we're going to be hearing, the linguistic turn was hugely influential throughout the 20th century. It dominated analytic philosophy, it dominated continental philosophy, and it loomed especially large in the work of the American philosopher Richard Rorty, who came to see philosophy as a subgenre of literature or poetry. Well, my guest this week is someone who studied with Richard Rorty in the 1980s and who's been thinking a lot lately about the linguistic turn, whether or not it's beginning to play itself out and what might be coming after it. His name is Crispin Sartwell. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, and he's the author of a recent piece in Eon magazine titled The Post-Linguistic Turn.
Well, I guess the phrase is forever associated with Richard Rorty and his anthology of 1967 called The Linguistic Turn. And what that was an attempt to retell the history of 20th century philosophy as a movement toward, almost exclusively toward, reflection on language. Now, I would say this started, you know, around the turn of the century, around 1900, in the analytic world. That's what Rorty was really thinking of, say, when he used the phrase, the linguistic turn. He meant people like Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore and the invention of analytic philosophy around the turn of the 20th century. And, I mean, one feature of this was frustration with the metaphysical speculations of the 19th century, of 19th century Kantianism and Hegelianism in particular, which seemed to be kind of stuck in an endlessly deepening repetition of early 19th century metaphysics. I mean, I don't know how deep to go at this point on this matter, but I tend to go kind of sociological on these things. And one central fact, I think, is there was a professional crisis within the university in both the UK and the US. One of my early papers tried to document that, like with presidential addresses from the APA or notes to the readers from the editor at Mind 1902 or something like this, where they're saying like, well, the sciences are making progress, but we don't seem to be making any progress. We don't even have criteria by which we could commonly recognize progress when we saw it. All we have is endless speculative controversies. And so meanwhile, the sciences are making great progress and even mathematics and so on. So I think like there's an idea that this is not intellectually respectable, not fully academically respectable as you get into the 20th century. So the linguistic turn is an attempt to get hold of a subject matter that can be rendered clear, that everyone can understand the expertise involved in a kind of linguistic, logical linguistic analysis of the kind that Russell could do in, say, Principia Mathematica. And also, it was a way of also addressing, in some sense, the traditional problems of philosophy. Like, what should we do with ethics? Well, the first thing let's do is analyze the meaning of ethical terms. And that seemed to take, I mean, this was Rorty's account. It took the whole profession on the analytic side I mean, it took some decades for that to dominate all the faculties, but it soon did. And so this was, and even on in continental philosophy as well, the turn toward the linguistic, somewhat later perhaps, and very differently motivated, was just as dramatic though. In Derrida, let's say, obsessed with language, right? Deleuze, Foucault, much of it, you know, Barthes, etc., you know? So it's just a dramatic convergence of a lot of 20th century thought on matters of language.
So as we see this idea developing through the 20th century that philosophical issues are reducible to issues of language, is that something where philosophers said, okay, henceforth, this is how we're going to practice philosophy as an inquiry into language? Or was it more a contention that the big philosophical questions had always come down to questions about language, even if the philosophers asking those questions hadn't realized it at the time?
Yeah, I mean, one contention was that the big philosophical questions were matters of linguistic confusion and would disappear when the language was clarified. Now, I mean, in a way, this picks up all kinds of strands in the history of philosophy. So, I mean, if you look at Plato, I mean, the basic activity of Socrates in Plato is defining terms. You know what I mean? Like, what is justice, Socrates? Okay, well, so, you know, it's going to take me hundreds of pages, but here it comes, you know? And so the idea that philosophers had an expertise in clearly defining terms, especially once you get the sort of logical equipment developed by Frege and Russell to perform that analysis. But the linguistic turn, and Rorty was impressed by this, among many others, was also radically revisionist about the scope of philosophy, very skeptical initially of all metaphysics, very skeptical of all value theory, of aesthetics and ethics, basically often saying that philosophy should not exist at all and maybe should be replaced by linguistic analysis. Or maybe on the continental side, that the discipline of philosophy was confused and what we could do is hermeneutics. The successor subject would be literary interpretation.
Okay, so what we're looking at here then is a twin crisis. It's an intellectual crisis at the beginning of the 20th century where the dominant philosophy of the 19th century comes to be seen as sort of woolly, abstract metaphysics that's no use to anyone. And also a professional crisis where science seems to be making progress and philosophy doesn't seem to be doing that. So then we have the linguistic turn. We have philosophers starting to develop systems of rigorous logic and linguistic analysis that can enable philosophy to carry itself proudly among the other sciences. How successful is all of this in reviving the fortunes of analytic philosophy as a professional discipline?
I thought it was quite successful. It almost turned into, amounted to a purge after a while. You know, like you sort of got rid of the older generation of metaphysicians or even ethicists and aestheticians and so on. Let's say you look at the Harvard philosophy department or Oxford and Cambridge in 1950. Okay, I say these within the universities, large, relatively large, prestigious departments, with famous people there, at least famous within the intellectual world. You know, I would say analytic philosophy in particular, which I know better than maybe the continental professional situation, I think it succeeded. I think it made philosophy viable through the whole 20th century as an academic discipline. In consolidating, codifying, creating a basically a testable expertise to train grad students in, this kind of stuff, I think it was quite successful in creating a respectable academic discipline.
And presumably in doing that, I mean, if this idea of the centrality of language to human experience starts out as a way of demolishing 19th century philosophy, presumably the urgency of that particular motivation diminishes as we move further into the 20th century. So can we sort of trace that process of linguistic constructionism beginning to take on a life of its own and a rationale of its own?
Yeah. I mean, I think Wittgenstein's a beautiful crystallization of that, early to late Wittgenstein. But also in other dimensions of 20th century intellectual history, right? Like the way anthropology started to focus on language, say the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, the idea that basically reality is created by our descriptions or representations of it. That becomes a sort of popular view in anthropology around mid-century as well, in a very similar vein. Now, one thing is like we're trying to define a precise expertise and, like you say, demolish 19th century metaphysics, like really explicitly. You know, that we're here to demolish 19th century metaphysics. But yeah, that doesn't keep you going for a century, right? And it's pretty self-involved. Yeah, so what Wittgenstein goes from saying, like, whereof we cannot speak, thereof we must be silent. Like, we can't even talk about metaphysics, ethics, and aesthetics. But then, I mean, he doesn't exactly withdraw that claim, but he goes to a completely different flavor of linguistic analysis. It's not, you know, proposition 1A.3, you know, it's a language is a form of life. A language is a culture. If we want to know what it is to be human or what it is to be the humans we are in the situation we are, we need to understand our language, which is our culture, which is our form of life. So now we start focusing much more carefully, empirically, on how people actually do communicate. Like ordinary language philosophy emerges, for example, where the issues have become quite different and much richer, you know. And now, yeah, it's overlapping with anthropology and all kinds of other intellectual developments in other fields, and including even in literature and in the arts, which are, I think, beginning to think of representations, broadly construed, including linguistic propositions, as articulating or making our experience, you know, or creating our shared world.
This is The Philosopher's Zone on Radio National and the ABC Listen app with me, David Rutledge. I'm talking this week with Crispin Sartwell about the linguistic turn in philosophy, what it is, how it started, how it developed, and whether or not philosophy might be beginning to turn away from its preoccupation with language. So in 1967, along comes the American philosopher Richard Rorty. He edits a collection of essays titled The Linguistic Turn, which sort of constructs a narrative of how philosophy got to this point. It's a tremendously influential book. And over the next couple of decades, we see Rorty developing this idea that philosophical concepts don't offer any sort of reflection on reality or truth or the world as it is. That philosophy is really about language and signs and vocabularies, more like a species of literature. And he gets to the point where he concludes that philosophy is pretty much done for, right? That it's doomed to go the way of theology. Can you tell me more about his thinking here?
This was an extremely popular view among top 20th century philosophers, that philosophy was over. I mean, there was a consensus on little else in a way, maybe across the continental analytic divide. But boy, they agreed on that. Carnap thought it was over. Wittgenstein thought it was over. Heidegger thought it was over, right? I mean, metaphysics, Nietzsche was the last metaphysician, I think, according to Heidegger. Derrida thought it was over. And it's one thing to do the logic a la Frege and Russell. By the time you get to Rorty, he's emphasizing language in terms of literary and poetic expression. He wants to talk about the construction of worlds in an artistic sense that happens in language. And he thinks that philosophy, if it is anything, if it ever had a use, it was that. It was a poetic construction of reality. Now, that means that its self-understanding was way off. It wasn't actually describing reality. It was expressively producing a reality. And he thought that maybe like philosophers should, he told me specifically that I shouldn't study philosophy and no one should. And there wouldn't be philosophy 20 years from now, back then. And it would merge into poetry or literature. Even right in the mid 80s, he's reading Nabokov, Orwell. He's sort of abandoned reading philosophers and he's reading literary figures and he's thinking of literature as a kind of successor, and literary theory as a maybe a successor subject to philosophy.
This is where I guess Rorty appears to have maybe one foot in the continental tradition. Let's talk about that, because what will come to be known as the continental tradition also takes a linguistic turn of its own. Can we talk a little bit about the way that that develops? I mean, Derrida is always the one that comes to mind first and foremost for me, but maybe we should begin with Heidegger. Is he an appropriate starting point here?
Yes, and I would say rereading Heidegger, he intermittently emphasizes language in a way that appears to, say, attribute kind of world-making powers to it, I guess. I don't want to express this too primitively or too pejoratively. So, for example, he says that the Greek temple sets up the Greek world. That's in the origin of the work of art. And as he goes on, he centralizes language more and more. Like, I guess one of his famous essays called On the Way to Language. He starts to associate language and being with a capital B, the history of language and the history of being with a capital B, whatever that is exactly in Heidegger, right? Merge in a number, especially of the later texts of Heidegger, and especially as interpreted by his student Gadamer, Hans-Georg Gadamer. And so, in a way, a whole discipline of Heideggerian style literary theory and literary interpretation emerges in the wake of Heidegger that centralizes language as much as it has been centralized in anywhere at any time. So Gadamer really attributes, like I say, kind of world-making power specifically to language. You know, we are always already embedded in language, says Gadamer. There's no possibility of thought or experience outside of language. We can't know what that is.
Well, I want to ask you if you think in some way the linguistic turn has played itself out. I mean, I know you've said that by the end of the 20th century, we begin to see a turn away from the linguistic turn. Why does this happen and then what begins to take its place?
Well, I do think we're beyond that now. It'd be worth like doing some empirical research on the journals and stuff like this to figure out like whether they're subjects of publication. And probably those things have, some of the research has been done. But my sense is that there's much, much less technical philosophy of language, either in technical in the sense of jargon laden in the continental or the analytic side. I think there's a number of reasons for this. Boy, I didn't know what I was going to do. So Richard Rorty told me straight up, like, there's going to be no discipline of philosophy in 20 years. You know, like, it's going into this kind of literary analysis or literary interpretation mode, or hermeneutics will be the successor. And, all right, so, but I just got a PhD in philosophy with him supervising, ironically enough. Now I've got to figure out what to do. Okay? So, like, it's over. And also, like, if you're thinking about adding, really contributing in a fundamental way to the philosophy of language, reflection on language, are you ready to go beyond late Wittgenstein? Are you ready? What do you have that needs to go beyond Quine or David Lewis, or is going to transcend Saul Kripke, or get beyond Derrida or deconstruct Derrida or something like that? You know, I think in partly in the intellectual history, it did reach its culmination. Like, I'm not saying that there couldn't be further revolutions. I'm saying I can't quite envision one. And coming right out of studying with Rorty, I didn't know what to do. And I was frustrated too. Like, I was making nasty cracks. Like, okay, so the whole 20th century obsessed with language. If the 21st century is obsessed with language, I'm going to catch up with some much needed shut eye. Here, you know, like I'm just like, so for partly it was like, what's the next possible creative project? And maybe it also reached a point of self-immolation or self-consumption in some of these developments, like in Derrida, and maybe even in Rorty, who I think moved in another direction after a while, where the language, it's all about language, but the language itself is slipping from our grasp, is no determinate signified. There's, you know, and I know the profession needed another refresher around the turn of the century again. You know, like I feel like it became so boring to read such refined work in epistemic logic or something like that, you know.
Well, what's happening now, or what's been happening maybe over the last 10, 15, 20 years, that you see as representing a turn away from the linguistic turn?
I think a lot of stuff happened in the late 20th century that was kind of opening up these traditions in certain ways. There was a return to metaphysics within analytic philosophy and inching in that way, even in Saul Kripke or David Lewis. There was a return to ethics with a vengeance in the late 20th century, you know, whether it's Hare or Philippa Foot and Anscombe. And I mean, there's a lot of great ethics in the late 20th century. So like there was sort of a bounce back of some traditional themes. But I think what's happening, what I see happening the last maybe, I guess the way I date this is from about 2010, is sort of a completely different mode of philosophical writing that's breaking out all over. I mean, I'm trying to work on documenting this or trying to define it. But like philosophy that's, people started to return to, and I think this is partly again due to even professional pressures. What can philosophy do for us? What practical difference? What does it help? How? What's the justification in terms of helping people or creating a better world in some way? Or what is it? What's it for? So I guess I think since about 2010, we're getting a lot more personal philosophy, a lot more self-helpy type philosophy. You know, how William James can help you address your depression or something like that, by John Cagg has a book like that. I think of a figure like Agnes Callard at the University of Chicago, who I just met briefly in the fall, who's everywhere, had a New Yorker profile and everything. You know, is famous for her surprising opinions over and over again, and her confessional material about her family and stuff like this. Okay, that's not stuff that anybody was doing in the 80s. Who was a philosophy professor? Not at all, okay? And so, first of all, a space is open for a much more sort of human-seeming contribution. Yeah, this confessional mode, practical mode, I compare it to Hellenistic philosophy, where it's not necessarily, I wouldn't expect new answers to basic philosophical conundra from them. But I would expect specific narratives of their lives that shed light on philosophical questions, like very broadly construed. Like for one thing, these figures have to, by and large, go back before 20th century philosophy. They're recovering, a lot of them are recovering ancient philosophies and, you know, or literally Hellenistic philosophies, you know, Stoicism or Epicureanism, and looking for material that could help people with problems. And then they're saying, and plus I am a people with problems. And here's my problems. John Cagg's narratives through American Philosophy, A Love Story, and then Hiking with Nietzsche, and then a couple books after that. He's really had lots of hard things to deal with, and he shares them so generously. And then he puts them in relation to, say, Nietzsche or William James, and he does that with expertise. That strikes me as a new phase, maybe something that I've been wanting really bad. Like, for one thing, just to focus on the writing. Like, it's a pleasure to read some of these people in a way that it just is not usually in academic philosophy, or hasn't been. I mean, I just think that if people are writing philosophy or something that's, you know, in that realm self-consciously, one thing I pick up from Callard, for instance, is like she enjoys writing. Like, hell, man, that is itself transgressive in academia, if you ask me. So, I mean, I think these folks are pretty different, you know, the turn toward memoir, confessional tone, you know, developing from 90s memoirs all the way to blogs and then, you know, like mommy blogs, or like all the way into, you know, the today's flavor of all these, or, you know, addiction memoirs and so on. Pretty soon everyone's trying that.
But if this confessional, accessible style of philosophy is taking off and more people are writing in this way, what does that mean for philosophy as a professional, sort of traditional discipline? Like, if the 20th century began with a professional crisis in philosophy, Could we be seeing another crisis at the beginning of the 21st century where all those intellectual tools that have been honed in analytic philosophy as a specialist scientific kind of practice, is all that going to become obsolete in some way, just sort of go out the window?
I guess I've been starting to wonder about this because, for one thing, I'm sort of in philosophy Twitter. And I mean, some of the stuff, I'm not going to name any names, but like I'm watching like, you know, people's illnesses, like I'm watching people's blisters get worse and worse, you know, philosophy professors as they reflect, as they put up Schopenhauer and a photo of the worst blister you ever saw on the back of their neck or something.
I know who you're talking about. I follow that guy on Twitter as well with the thing on the back of his neck. Yeah, that was horrible.
Real-time rehab, right? Like maybe, you know, like people are going like, yeah, you know, I knew I shouldn't have smoked that meth and then taught my class in the morning or whatever. So there's that. Like this could go too far in a way, I guess. I guess I've known some pretty screwed up philosophy professors, though, whether they were confessional or not over the decades. I also really do wonder about, I mean, I'm in my head committed to trying to make progress on the traditional philosophical issues. And I don't necessarily see this material as headed in that direction. But I maybe not haven't seen everything that's going on. But like, I would like to see a turn away from the personal or back toward using the personal. You know, can you bring a new insight to ethics or aesthetics or political philosophy from this experience that would challenge the going ideas in those subdisciplines or the traditions in those disciplines or the basic questions of like, what is justice, let's say? Like, I don't think that's questions over. I don't think it's inapplicable. I'm not sure that the figures I'm talking about are the kind of tradition or the 2,500 word essay necessarily, exactly, or much less the tweet, are really the way you contribute to that. So I'm wondering if there's a move that combines the personal turn with, a much more intellectually hefty, theorized, independently theorized. Like, no, we're not just returning to the Stoics or recovering the pragmatists or something. We're challenging where we're developing new ideas in these areas from these experiences or showing how they could fuel that. I think that remains as a task, I guess, I feel like.
Crispin Sartwell, he's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. He's also the author of an excellent recent article in Eon magazine titled The Post-Linguistic Turn, and we'll put a link to that on the Philosopher's Zone website. Don't forget, you can access this and all of our past programs via the ABC Listen app, and I really hope you can join me next time. I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.